You take all those X-rays and stuff about the character, and it would have been melted down into basically a murder mystery in a small town. And I thought, when that happened, you know what? They really don't get me. They don't understand what I'm trying to do. They don't understand my work. So I had one more book to do after that, and I was going south. So after that, I decided, you know, I'm going to do something different. I'd like to do something very, very different. So I did Speaks of Night Work. And I wanted to take it someplace different than Pocket. So Pocket is not getting it all. So I had a situation where I went to Viking with Speaks of Night Work, and I got involved with a editor that was just, to me, the editor from hell. We didn't get along at all. We didn't see anything eye to eye. She doesn't understand anything about the era I was trying to write in. She didn't understand anything about the language. She wanted to make it an historical romance. She wanted the end to be that Matthew and Rachel were married at the end, and they had a happy ever after life. And, you know, we just didn't get along at all. So there were some political things involved there at Viking. But what basically happened was that, you know, I refused to do the changes she wanted me to do. That made her mad, and basically I was kind of, you know, well, I'm mad. Get out of here. Take your work and go elsewhere. And that's basically how it turned out. And then, so I thought my writing career was over. And I thought it was over on the basis that I was trying to do something different with my career. I'm trying to do some kind of different writing. And I really ran into a lot of resistance because I was trying to do something different and something better, I thought, than what I'd done before, or something very different. And in the publishing business, it's like a big corporation, of course. It's like, you know, we'll continue doing what you've done before, as long as you make money. You know, keep doing what you do. My thing has been, I never wanted to be told to do that I have to do a particular type of thing. I don't want to be put in the closet, I want to be put in a box. So I said, well, basically I'm taking my ball and going home. And I thought I was done with publishing. I thought I was through. So I was doing a reading of Speaks Library at Birmingham. And there was a local publisher, and they said, what's going on in the book? I said, nothing. They said, well, let's have a chance. So they did a good job, and River City Press is the name of the publishing house. And they did a pretty good job. And then I happened to see a friend of mine from Pocket in New York when I was up there for a book pitching. He said, what's going on with the paperback? And I said, nothing. He said, well, let us. And then that's when they did the two versions. That was an experiment. Unfortunately, I found that
they break it in two. They make more money.
They broke it into two. I think to save, I don't know. And then even now they can't tell you. I was going to say to save money on printing costs. I don't know.
They claimed it was too thick to do as a single paperback, but I think it was to make more money.
But the deal is, I mean, I got letters to that point. People asking me if I was insane and why I began the story when I began it, and it just begins what, like, with no setup. And because they were reading the second book first.
Yeah.
You know, they had no idea that there had even been a first book. Because really, Pocket did not do a lot of promotion. And that's been my problem with Pocket for many years, is that they, you know, they just don't do a lot of promotion. It's like, you know, they throw the books, the books stick on the wall, fine, but, you know, so, but anyway, so I decided to do this series, make a series out of this, and then came to Bill Schaefer at Subterranean. I have a book I just finished in October called The Five. It's a contemporary novel about a rock band on their last tour in the Southwest, set in 2008. And that's making the rounds of publishers now. I don't know when that's going to be out, or when it's going to be publishing that, but we'll see. I'm very excited about that. And my plans for the future are to do a Matthew Corbett series book, and then do a contemporary novel, and do a Matthew book, and do a contemporary novel for the next more than 10 years. Because I've got, my series is going to be 10 books in all, and so I'll be, so I've done 3 books, and 7 more books to go. So I have a pretty full plate. I'm making up for the time that I just spent sitting around the house watching soap operas and walking.
Come on, confess, which ones were you watching?
Which ones? Well, you know, hey, they're almost all gone now.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
General Hospital, I really didn't watch. Somebody asked me what I did during that time, and I remember walking and doing a lot of thinking about
it. Well, you kind of depressed.
I was depressed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was very depressed. You know, I didn't realize at the time, but I was depressed. Because, you know, writing is what I think I was meant to do. I think it's what I was born to do. And it took me a while to come to that realization of, you know, what else could I do? Could I work at a library? Could I work at a bookstore? What else could I do? And I thought, you know, my joy is creating. My joy is writing. So this is what I was really born to do. And there's a point while I'm working, that comes to fruition to me. And I feel like it's all come together. This is what I was meant, put on earth to do. And, you know, and sometimes you have to fight, or many times, you have to fight to do what you think you feel you're put on earth to do. And there are many, many forces out there that don't want you to do what you're put on earth to do, what you feel called to do. But, you know, but I feel a strength in that. I feel a strength that I'm called to do this work. That's not fun. But I feel like I'm supposed to do this work.
Can I ask you?
Yes.
Have you ever met Harlan Ellison?
Yeah.
And well, Harlan's had his problems.
Oh, he has. Of course he has. And, you know, we were just
talking about who are, you know, running the business.
Right. And, you know, I admire him so much. And because I admire him for his stand he's taken.
That's right.
And the stand is, the artist's voice, the artist is the king.
That's right.
The artist's voice is the voice of the king. And know what, these lackeys, you know, just step aside and let me do my thing. Step aside, you know. But of course, he's had, and publishing being a corporate entity and a lot of egos involved. Sure. Of course, Harlan has a huge ego, but that's, you know, it's okay. It's okay.
It comes with the territory.
Yeah, it comes with the territory. So he's going to be in continual, you know, collusion with his, with the
corporate. He knows what he's doing.
He knows what he's doing.
Because he's centered.
Yes, he knows what he's doing. And that's a wonderful thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Here's a, you were talking about the two book, the two paperback book version of Speaks the Nightbird. Typical of what Pocket has done with these, right now, or at least a few weeks ago, last time I looked, volume one is still in print. Volume two is out of print.
Yeah.
So you can't even buy both parts anymore. And that's just typical of what...
And it's frustrating, and you know, it's never easy dealing with the corporate people. Because I think really a lot of corporate people now stop reading. I don't think they read. That's certainly true in Hollywood. Now, Hollywood studios have readers. They have actual people who do reading. They actually are paid to read. And they read scripts and stuff, screenplays for these people who say they don't have time to read. But I think more and more in publishing, people are not reading. They're not readers. For instance, this editor I work with, that I had this collision with at Viking, it amazed me because she did not know many words in that book. She didn't know many words in the book. There's a famous religious essay pamphlet from the 1600s called Leviathan, and I mentioned that in my book. And she said, "What does that word mean?" And you know, when you hear that come from a professional editor, and this person has got a lot of books to her credit. But she does mostly women, light women's, and I say women's, it's mostly chick flick type books.
Okay. How did she get assigned to you?
That's always been a question I had no idea. Though she knew the agent I was working with at that time, so I think it had to do with that.
She works for Viking, it's one of the most prestigious publishers.
Absolutely. And that building is a temple when you go in there. I thought, when I arrived at the temple, walk in there, marble floors, got the columns, and it's got all the great books and online. And you feel like, for a writer, you feel like you have come to a temple. These people really get it. And then when you run into somebody like that, my God, you think this, you know, the dream has turned into the nightmare with a very quick turnaround.
Yeah.
But anyway, she did not know the word Leviathan, and she said, "You can't tell me that people talked about religion and they were as religious as you make them out to be in this book in this era."
Say what?
Because she was a fairly young woman, and I think there's the idea that, you know, no history is beyond 1972.
Oh,
you know, before 1972, and everything must be up to date, and everything must be for today's young audience and today's whatever, which I firmly disagree with. I think a reader is a reader, and I think readers enjoy big books and enjoy complex plots. She would say no. There are another instance that I mentioned, somebody in a tavern was playing a guitar, which is the relative of the guitar. And she said, "What is this guitar? G-I-T-T-U-R-N." I said, "It's a relative of the guitar." She said, "Well, just say guitar then." I said, "Well, you know, it's really not the same. It's not the same. It's not exactly the same. It's more like a lute, but it's called a guitar." She said, "Well, your readers won't care." And you know, for somebody in publishing to say that, and I know I sound like I'm browsing quite a lot, but for someone in publishing to say that is a sin. Their readers are not going to care.
When you consider that even the chick flicks still have glossaries.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for items of clothing, for items of daily use that are no longer there, for terms that were are no longer polite but were back then, and explanatory, etc.
Right.
And that, and that's just for the really light, you know, because I still read some of that light fiction, and, and a lot of it reads as if the initial book was I don't know, what do you do with CGI for books, but it's like they plugged the book in and, and said, okay, let's make the blonde a brunette, let's move it 150 miles over,
there's
another book, you know.
There are businesses that put those books together, and they put them together in boardrooms, they really do. They say, you know, this is our script to do the book, and we're going for a certain demographic.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I completely reject that. But that's kind of the way the publishing business is going.
Well, but, you know, if you're going to let your kids watch cartoons all Saturday, you couldn't let them, young adults, read cartoon books in the daytime. One of the important things, I think, for young adults, and I don't mean preteens, I mean young adults all the way up through, is that they at least read. I really don't care what anymore. Just, you know, get the habit of turning the page.
Right. Well, you know, I speak to a lot of high schoolers, and the thing that I emphasize is that these high schoolers don't realize they're being led around by the nose because of their lack of reading. And I say, you know, you need to read because reading will help you think. It helps your thinking process. It hones your decision-making process. And if you don't read, there are plenty of forces and powers out there who don't want you to read because they don't want you to think, because they want you to buy what they tell you to buy. They want you to go where and do what they tell you. So I said, the only way to remain independent in this world that's now and to come is to read and learn to think independently. Some get that. Some look up and say, you know, others, unfortunately, they don't.
Reading at home and then watching TV.
They don't get it because these things are so easy. And they're offered up so easily, and then their peer group says, oh, this is a cool thing to do, this is right. And they get sucked into that vacuum and just takes them away.
Reading is fundamental. It's not just a marketing ploy. It is fundamental
to human thinking.
Right.
Decision making,
well,
absolutely.
Well, are you encouraged because of the popularity of Harry Potter? Harry Potter books?
I'm encouraged by that because anything that helps imagination to me is a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. But then again, Harry Potter, that, you know, that series was turned down at least a dozen times. It's not like that Walt Stinn and everybody in the publishing world said, this is going to be great and people will enjoy reading this. You know, and the last thing they were thinking is young people will really get something out of this. This will help young people think. Their number one thing is, you know, it's going to sell to a lot of people.
Yeah, because I can't tell you how grateful I felt when I saw, you know, 12, 13, 14-year-old walking around with this big 800-pound and 800-page book.
Yeah. And did you ever get a chance to go to any of the midnight, when they actually went on sale?
Are you familiar with Joseph Beth Booksellers?
Yeah.
I helped open the Cincinnati store in 93, and when Harry Potter came along,
I know. It's a great thing, though, to see kids reading. That many people waiting in anticipation.
Exactly.
Isn't that a great thing?
Yes.
There have been other guys.
And so many in costume, too.
Yeah. And so many in costume. Well, but they made it a fun thing, too. Yeah. They made it
exactly.
It's a fun thing, but they enjoyed getting into the world, and I'm all for that.
Or even things like the Twilight series.
Or Living Snicket. The Twilight series, I mean, my daughter loves the Twilight series. I try to read the Twilight series. I just can't read it.
Uh-huh.
It just falls so flat.
Yes.
There's just nothing there. I mean, I understand the story, but
it's actually teenagers.
The teenage girl.
My daughter loves it. Loves them. So, and really loves the movies. But anyway, that's kind of where I am now. I'm making up for lost time, I think. But I have the conviction now that I am doing what I need to do and have to do and what I'm here to do. And I'm very proud of where I am. I've been through a lot with publishers. I'm sure I'm going to go through a lot with publishers. That's it. But you just have to keep going.
Thank God they haven't brought you down.
Pardon?
Thank God they haven't brought you down.
Right. Well, I got it actually went so far that I got the actual edited manuscript from this particular editor. And I pulled it out of the bag, and I was looking at it, and I tried to make it, and it's just like, I just can't make it. I just can't do that. And my agent at that time said, Rick, just do the work. Just do the work. But you know, you just can't do the work. Mm-hmm. You just can't do it. If you feel you've done your best already, you've done your best.
Yeah.
Someone says, well, change it because I don't like that. And you need to dumb it down. You need to do this, that, and the other.
Can't give
it. You can't do it. You may have to walk through hell. Mm-hmm. You may have to be out of the industry for 8 years. Mm-hmm. But there are some things you cannot do. You cannot be forced to do. You cannot be made to do. You can't allow yourself to do. So that was kind of a crisis for me, but I think I got through it.
Mm-hmm. Is your work that I'm appearing in Kindle, the electronic stuff?
It started with it.
Is it?
It's just starting to. Yeah, some of the stuff started to come out.
Right now,
there's a little confusion about. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, Swan Song and The Queen of Bedlam are currently available for the Kindle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That whole deal, I mean, of e-readers, that has a long way to go to get standardized. So right now, there's a bubble. You know, we're talking about bubbles, financial bubbles, housing bubbles. And in publishing right now, that's a bubble, the e-reader. Nobody really knows where that's going to go. And a lot of people are excited about the idea of e-readers. But interesting thing is going on now because Amazon is promoting the Kindle by saying if a book goes on sale at midnight, you can have it for 12:01. Now the publishers are saying, wait just a minute, you can have the new book, but 3 months later because we won't be able to sell the hard copy of the book
right.
the first 3 months,
right?
So you see where that's going. That's a collision.
Because so they want to treat the Kindle like a DVD.
Right. And people who buy the Kindle want to feel like, oh, well, I'll be able to get the newest bestseller right now. They can't. They have to wait about 3 or 4 months. So that's going to be an interesting situation to watch that play out.
Kindle should have an enrollment then that will give them the equivalent of season tickets in an upper box.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about a Kindle is it's the size it is, so on and so forth, and it's got a nice screen and so forth, but it requires electricity.
I don't need electricity
for a printed book.
Right.
All I want to do is open it up, and there it is.
Well, the book really is the perfect medium. I mean, it's the perfect form as it is.
Yep.
So, but publishing business has gotten all excited because they need to feel like they're getting the digital age.
Cutting edge, yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
I guess about. And we'll see what happens, I guess, next week when on the 27th when the Mac comes out.
That's right. Turning it off.
Whatever.
The publishers feel like, you know, they're behind the times. They feel like they want to get involved in digital stuff, digital media. So that's really the reason they're pushing it.
I'm sorry, that was Washington calling.
Okay.
202, well, I mean, come on.
Are you late for your own boardroom meeting?
I'm not Washington. Well, no one knows I'm here.
Oh, could be somebody.
It's Joel. I'm just not here.
Okay. I don't think you ever are.
Okay. I don't have one.
Did the critics kind of pitch you?
You don't have a cell phone.
No.
Yes.
Are you Stephen King?
One of those Kindles. But yes.
Yeah. Well, the deal is that when I came on board as a writer, and the first book I ever wrote was published, and so that means I kind of had to learn how to write in public because I had no trunk novels. Most writers have trunk novels. You know, they do a novel and put the book aside. Not me. The first book I ever did was published. But I fit a need at that time because King was getting to be hot. And I did this horror novel, I guess it was 78 or so. And it's like, oh, here's a guy who can do this. And Avon picked me up. So the first few books I did, it was all like, if you like King, you like this guy. You know. So that began to get some critics, people really love King, and there are, of course, many people just adore him. He's an excellent writer. That made them very angry because, you know, they didn't want anybody to be compared to King. And I'm not saying that I'm not comparing myself to King, but the publishers, as a selling point, wanted to compare me to King. So there was a little backlash from critics. Some critics were like, oh, this guy thinks he's like Stephen King. And then I remember I was in one newspaper, and it was like the most horrible thing. It was a picture of me, and then it was a headline that said, "The man who would be king." If there's anything that is designed to bring critics and out of the woodwork, that's going to bring them out, and you're going to get savaged.
Yeah.
You know. So that went on for a while, and that, you know, it's like you're trying to do your own, get your own world across, and also I was still learning how to write. So I don't think I really became much of a writer until Boys Life. I think with Boys Life, I kind of knew what I was doing.
Did you and Stephen King ever talk about this? I mean, did he?
We never did talk about it. Never did.
No.
No. And when I say we talk, I mean, we don't really talk. We've communicated a few times by email. And I've seen him at conventions and stuff. But we never really talked about that.
Well, I must say that Mystery Walk and the Wolf's Hour, very, very entertaining.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good. But what was happening for a while, it was beginning to talk about getting depressed. It was beginning to get on my nerves where on forums and websites, people would compare my work to King's work, and I never even read stuff. Saying like, well, you know, don't you think, for instance, the wolf figure in Talisman, don't you think the wolf in Wolf's Hour is 2 months like that character? Now, I never read, you know, I was comparing to stuff I'd never read, so it's like it became almost a game mm-hmm. for some people to play. But it does get to you a little bit. You think, you know, well, you're working on creating your own voice, but you're getting some people angry because they, for whatever reason, you're getting people angry. I don't know. But
He says nice stuff about your work.
He does.
He mentions you in his book on writing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. And he gave a great blurb for Speaks the Nightbird when that was published.
Yeah. He did. So you know, we had no problem. It's just been critics, you know. But it's okay. It's okay. But that's really one of the reasons I wanted to do something different. I wanted to do some historical work. Because I wanted to do something that you know, was it's just completely different, off the wall, you know, absolutely different.
Yeah, I heard about Mr. Slaughter. And the plot is there's a serial killer loose in, like, colonial times?
Yeah. Or? Yeah. If you know the series, do you know anything about
the series? No. I'm a little late to this, but okay. I was intrigued when I got the offering up for Indian Press and laid out the plot system.
The series is about a young man who is starts as a law clerk in, it Speaks of Nightbird. It's a case of a woman's accused of being a witch. And so he helps solve this mystery. And then the next book, Queen of Bedlam, he's a law clerk. And he becomes initiated into an early American problem-solving agency, which is like a detective agency. So he's a problem-solver. He becomes a detective. So there's a mystery to be solved in Queen of Bedlam. And it flows also into Mr. Slaughter. And in his official capacity as a problem-solver, he and his assistant go to transport this very dangerous man from this insane asylum to the docks of New York, put him on a ship to England. And he escapes. And so the book is Matthew trying to get this man back. He's extremely dangerous. I'm going to do 10 books in the series. I've done, you know, 3. And so the fourth one, I'll start working on it pretty soon. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm already working on it mentally, but not physically. Yeah. Did you have some? We talked about some questions.
Yeah, well, one of the questions that was coming up with names for Matthew Corbett, how did you come up with?
Yeah, we were talking before we came in here, questions that he was going to ask us. We have talked a lot. We've done a lot of interviews. And we talked, well, what are some questions he's never asked, you know? So Matthew Corbett, the name, and I said, there's a story behind it. I wanted a name that sounded, the first name to be a little bit, Matthew to me sounds a little bit biblical. Yeah. You know, you have that, it's a strong name. Also, I grew up watching Gunsmoke. And I remember when the deputy would say Matthew, called him Matthew. So that just sounded right to me, and Matt Dillon, right? So that Matthew worked well. Corbett is from my interest in boxing. Jim Corbett. And was that late 1800s, early 1900s, I think? 1800s?
Thereabouts. Turn of the century.
Yeah, turn of the century. A very elegant man that they said had a strike like just could knock you out. So he appeared to be elegant. He was a genteel guy. It was a movie starring Harold Flynn, played the part. And he fit. He fits the pictures. So anyway, a very elegant guy who could strike quickly and take care of his foes, and that's where that came from.
That's not what I would have guessed.
Is that not what you would get?
Tom Corbett Space Cadet is what I was
thinking. Maybe I have something to do with it too. I don't know. But I used to read those books.
Yeah.
You never know. But that's where I think it came from.
So continuing that with other names in the books, the Mr. Slaughter's name is Taranthus Slaughter, which I think is a great name, or at least that's one of the names he goes by.
Taranthus, right.
Almost like T.S.
T-Rex. Almost like T-Rex.
Sure.
And there's a point in the book where they talk about one of the guys in the town has found, he collects bones, he collects skeletons, and he's like the coroner.
Yeah.
And he has a strange thing that was found in a coal mine in England by his grandfather. His great-grandfather found, he was giving him as payment, a tooth, and it's a jagged tooth, and it's like the tooth of, is it the tooth of Leviathan, is it the tooth, whatever, they don't know what it is, but of course it's a, we would know now, it's a dinosaur's tooth, right? So he's got one of these. So that's setting up the idea that, and then setting up the idea that there can be, there were, it can be, still be monsters loose on the earth, right? So T-Rex comes from that idea that he found the dinosaur tooth, and Slaughter is like a monster. And then also one of the characters has a recurring dream that he's running from this creature that had this tooth, and it leaps upon his back and drives him down. And that actually is what happens to him in the course of the book, when Mr. Slaughter jumps on his back and drives him down.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Tyrannosaurus. Tyrannus.
It's a great name.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Hudson Greathouse.
Hudson Greathouse.
Another good name.
Yeah. Thank you.
Because I mean, the name implies, you know, I mean, in Mr. Slaughter, you call him the Great One a lot.
The Great One. Yeah. Because I wanted to give him, I didn't want to stop saying Greathouse every time.
Yeah.
So.
But I mean, it just, you know, Greathouse is a great name for that kind of strong, imposing.
Imposing. He's a big guy.
Yeah.
But let me talk a little bit about how I began writing and why I began writing. I grew up in Birmingham, and I grew up, my father was a drummer in a band, and my father and mother divorced pretty early. And my mom wanted to be an actress, so she went to Hollywood and kind of left me in the care of my grandparents. My grandfather had the first apartment store in Birmingham, Alabama. It was a pretty huge store. And so I grew up on an estate. I grew up in a large house, large estate. But we lived in a part of town where we were the only house of its kind in that area. And so our neighbors were like, you know, half a mile away. And I had really no other kids around. And no, you know, and set me apart also in high school and in school. You know, you're different from other people. You know, you're different, you're privileged, or you're different, or whatever. I have never fit anywhere. I don't fit anywhere. And that hurt me for a while, but now I'm kind of proud of it. I don't fit anywhere. You know, I don't fit I don't fit with really hardcore horror writers. I don't really fit with fantasy or science fiction writers. I don't really fit with mystery writers. I don't fit in Birmingham with a literary Southern writing heritage. I don't really fit with that. I don't really fit anywhere. But the deal is, I still am me, and I have to be who I am, and I have to embrace that I don't fit anywhere. Instead of thinking that's a detriment, it's a positive thing. And I think in a way, you know, I think I became a writer because I was a solitary person, and I kind of created this fantasy world for myself to go into at night and write. Because I didn't really have a lot of friends. I didn't have any kids living around me. And I think if you look at the lives of writers, very, very few writers are really, really social types. I mean, there are a few who are very gregarious and they go out and just tear up the town. But very few writers are really socially gregarious. In my case, you know, I began my inward journey, my inward exploration at a very early age. And I think I was always aware of things around me in a way that the people around me were not. And I think I was always, for whatever reason, drawing things in. I was thinking about, well, why does this person have to wear the shirt they wear? You know, why do they wear their hair the way they wear? Why do they listen to the way they talk, the cadence of the language, the way they sit, the way they move, the way they walk, the expression in people's faces. You know, all those things I begin to draw in from a very early age. So how else can you use those skills, which were kind of given to me, I think, by God, really, because this is how I was born. How can you use those except by writing, by creating, you know, by expressing yourself, but what you've seen? Yes?
Yeah, you said you sold the first novel you ever wrote. How old were you with that?
Well, the deal was, I always wrote short stories. Even when I was 6 years old, I was writing short stories, and I was always writing. But I wanted to be a journalist because I thought, you know, even though I enjoy writing short stories and stuff, I'm never going to be able to be a writer because that's just what somebody else does. you know, that's another world. That's like, I could never do that, you know. So I thought I'd be a journalist. And when I finished college, I got a job at a newspaper, and I wanted to be a journalist. I got a job at a newspaper, but I couldn't be a reporter. I had to be write headlines and edit copy. And I wanted to do feature stories. So I had a list of feature stories that I wrote down, and I said, I'd like to do this kind of thing. So I gave it to the city editor. And the city editor, he had a chair very much like this. He did. He had one of these executive boardroom type chairs. And he sat back, and he said, McCammon, as long as I'm city editor, you will never write for this newspaper. He said, because your role is on the copy list. Your role is writing headlines. Your role is checking the stories of other people. You will never write. And I thought, you know, I'm in a dead-end job. I'm not going to go anywhere, so I have to do something. So I wrote my first book almost in desperation. And I guess I was 20. Remember how old I was?
25.
25.
When it was published.
But that idea of knowing your role has continued to rankle me throughout my life. The idea that, you know what? You do what you do because I say you do it. No. You do what you do. You know your role. You stay in your place. My whole career has been this. My whole career has been finding different doors. You know, you're going to run into a lot of walls. And there are going to be a lot of people who say, no, you can't go through this door because I say you can't go through this door. And I may try to break the door down. I mean, I may you know, break my leg trying to do it. But, you know, my thing has been, I say what my role is. Because the number one thing about writing to me that is the most important thing to me, I want to tell a story. I want to tell a story to myself, number one. But the most important thing about writing to me is freedom. Freedom to go and do whatever I want to do. That's what I always look forward to doing. Writing is freedom. And nobody is going to tell me what I can and cannot do. And I will fight anybody, anywhere, over that issue.
Did you ever base a character on that guy?
I have a guy in the new book who's based on that. The new book.
What, Mr. Slaughter?
The Five is the new book about the rock and roller. The rock and roll book is it's autobiographical, a lot of it is. But the new guy is a real fighter. And he's like, you know, nobody tells me what to do. So, yeah.
So are you, do you play?
Do I fight?
No, do you play? He's a rock and roll fan.
Well, I do fight. I play keyboards. I'm not rock and roll. But, I mean, I play, you know, yeah. But not in a rock and roll band.
Okay, you've never been in a band?
No. But I'm thinking about doing a podcast.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I'm doing a music podcast because I've got tons of 60s music. I love 60s garage rock, one-hit wonders type.
Not just stuff.
Yeah. A lot of great stuff, you know. Yeah. And it may have been a hit in one part of the country and other people in other parts of the country know nothing about it, you know. So I'm thinking about doing a podcast, a monthly podcast of strange and weird music. 60s.
Have you ever listened to Lil Steven's show?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much really weird stuff out there.
Yeah.
The 60s in particular, great era for experimentation. That's what I don't see a lot of these days, experimentation, because also music is very corporate.
Right.
You know, the corporate influence on things is just to destroy experimentation. We were talking a little earlier about a thing I think is important, because you mentioned Harlan also. When you said Harlan thought a book, one of the values of a book was that it was a little bit difficult for people to get their mind around and a little hard to read.
Well, he actually said it because I think people should struggle with what they read.
Yeah,
meaning that they should really think about it.
They should think about it.
And not just be this fast.
It should be a little challenging. It should be a challenge.
Well, that explains Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, the corporate influence does not want that necessarily. They want everything to be easy and everything to be light. And then that evolves into lower and lower standards. So somebody's got to fight it.
Another kind of independent writer, I wonder if you're familiar with Lucius Shepard.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Does most science fiction, right?
He writes all over the and he's very socially active with people in Central America.
Well, anyway, that's kind of who I am, where I am. That's where I'm going. Next book will be out. Well, I'm not finished with the next book. I haven't started yet. I don't know when the five will be out. Hopefully next year. I said this year, my dad will be next year. So anyway, any other questions?
Also, influences. Charles Dickens at all?
Yes, Charles Dickens. For the complexity of the characters and the complexity of the stories, because I always have enjoyed. And see, that kind of brought me into we were talking about the comparisons with King. Because I know he really enjoys Charles Dickens, yes, too. And he writes very involved, of course, very involved books, yes, very involved characters. And I've always enjoyed big, thick books with a lot going on, a lot of people, a lot of characters. And so, you know, I naturally go to that also. So, yes, Charles Dickens. And also Ray Bradbury, as we were talking about in this last panel. Mystery writers, a lot of mystery writers, and I grew up reading science fiction, though I never really wrote science fiction, but I had to know the big stacks of the science fiction magazines and stuff that I still have. A lot of things in there, and a lot of things. As in everyone, everybody has a lot of influences in their lives for what they do, and so a lot of stuff in there.
One of the things that I've always enjoyed so much as a fan of your work is how each book was so different from what came before it. You know, there was Swan Song, and then mm-hmm. that was followed by Stinger, which was nothing like Swan Song.
Right.
That, you know, the B movie feel, science fiction.
Well, I wanted to be different, and that's, you know.
And so, you keep it going with the Matthew Corbett series. Well, each one of those books is a different kind of.
There's a continuation, but I didn't want all those books to be different too. I wanted them to have a little different feel. One's going to be an intellectual exercise, an intellectual mystery. I want the next one to be more action-oriented, which is true of Quentin Bedlam and Mr. Slaughter, certainly more action-oriented. But then the next one will be sort of a mix of both. It's more of a mix. So, and also there are things in the series that connect, and there are going to be characters who appear in, like, the second book who appear in, like, the sixth book. So, but you still have to fix it so that if people don't know what's happened before, in each book you kind of have to fill people in as succinctly as possible, let them know, you know, what they missed or what they haven't missed, you know, to keep people interested in the series. So it's a real challenge. I've never written a series before, so it's a real challenge.
Are they pure mysteries, or is there a supernatural element?
There is a little supernatural that's beginning to creep in. There is a little strangeness that's beginning to creep in. And somebody asked me why I chose this era. You know, I think this era is interesting. It's kind of creepy in a way because of all the, it's just the isolation of people. And you had the city, right? New York's got 5,000 people. But then outside that, it's just isolation, you know? But I remember seeing, and this goes back to my influence also, the great Hammer horror films. There was a great movie called, at least it was great to me, now it's evidently it's got terrible reviews, but it's called Night Creatures. It's from the 60s, and it was set in the Revolutionary era. And it was creepy. I remember as a kid just being creeped out by the lamplight, you know, just the atmosphere. I love the atmosphere, the creeping sort of strange.
Was that one of those Hammer movies?
It was Hammer, yeah. Peter Cushing was in it.
DVD.
You got it? You got it? Are you seeing it? Well,
is it Night?
Night Creatures. Well,
that's where those guys drive riding around in those skeleton outfits. Right. And
that's
in the dark.
Yes.
I got that on DVD. It's
that's right.
They have a Hammer collection of about eight movies.
Okay, it's in there. Right. So I think that I love that atmosphere.
Peter Cushing
is in it. Right. So the atmosphere is gothic. So there's kind of a emperor of crime called Professor Fell, who's not, you've not seen him yet. I'm not sure if you'll see him in the third, in the next book either, but you will eventually see him. He is on a quest for something that may or may not have a supernatural element. I'm not quite sure yet, but that's kind of where I'm going. Now the new book, the five, would you say that's supernatural or is not? There is an element.
Yeah, it has a supernatural element to it.
But it's really not horror, is it? Not really.
I wouldn't call it horror.
Though it has, you know, elements, I guess.
There's some, even the Matthew books have some horrific imagery.
Yeah.
There are certain scenes that could be called horror.
Of course, then you have to get into the question of horror, what is horror and what is not.
Yeah, you know,
that's
right.
Very broad.
That's true, too.
You could go around and around for hours talking about it.
But supernatural element was what I always used.
Supernatural, yeah.
Because you have something like Silence of the Lambs, and that always more in the mystery crime fiction.
Well, there is that's what the five is, the supernatural element. Is it supernatural, or is it just people are crazy?
Yeah.
And you can't really tell as you read it. It's there, but it's unclear if it's supposed to be supernatural or not.
Well, there is. I think there is a supernatural element.
Yeah, I mean,
so, but
somebody who doesn't want to see that can easily interpret it as not supernatural.
It's not, right.
I think.
It could be a mental.
Yeah.
Like a Henry James thing.
Sort of.
Or Dexter or something like that. That has a...
Absolutely. Yeah.
When you were writing your earlier stuff, did the publisher, like, set you up with a contract or give us a novel each year kind of thing?
No, I never wanted to go for that. I don't want to be at anybody's beck and call.
Did you have to present an outline and say, my next book is about this, and they go, that sounds good?
No, I've never done that. I don't want to do that. It's amazing to me, I meet writers who do that, well-established writers who will do that. And to me, again, that's freedom. I want to be able to finish the book, turn the book in, because I want to write what I want to write. But there are many authors who say, wait for their editors or publishers to give them, the okay.
To just do what you want to do, and then I do your agent kind of hunt around?
Yes. That's how it always worked. That's how it always will work.
Who's your agent now?
Agent is Don Moss. Don Moss Agency. Yeah, pretty good.
That's been part of the problem that you've had with the publishing industry is they've always wanted a certain kind of book, and you've never let them tell you what to do. So when they get the next one, it's not what they were expecting. And then that causes problems.
I know, because see, if they're in a mindset for a particular type of book, and they get, and it's like, oh, well, we know what we're getting now, and then I turn in something that's very different, it's like, what in the world is this? And that happened with Boys Life. They didn't get it. That was a devastating thing to me. And actually, that's where, if I had any trials and tribulations in publishing, it began there.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, but you won the World Fantasy Award for that book.
I did. That doesn't mean anything to publishing.
Really?
No.
It means something to readers.
Same thing is true with Speaks the Nightbird, won several awards. Nothing quite as major as World Fantasy, but it won several awards. And had he done what the editor wanted,
it would have been destroyed. It would have been destroyed, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Boys Life would have been destroyed. And Speaks the Nightbird would have been destroyed. But the deal is, as I'm understanding, as I'm realizing, there's a big disconnect between what readers like and what publishing people. And again, I say, because you know what you guys read. You guys read, you read a lot, and I'm beginning to think that it's...
Well, as you and I have talked before, the heads of the publishing companies now are professional CEOs. They're not readers who became CEO of the publishing company. They're people who are brought in because they were CEO of whatever company.
Yeah. Back in 2003, 2004, Stephen King got an award from the American Booksellers Association. And he made the same point that people, there's a disconnect between what readers want and what you guys are doing.
Is that right? You did it well. Yeah, absolutely right. Sure.
And the woman who won the National Book Award, they asked her about King getting an award. They said, I don't have time for people like that.
I know.
Well, that makes me crazy.
He has lots of stories about how his relationship with his publishers, even though he did so well, he had so many millions of readers. That they still felt he got very little respect at Doubleday and Viking also, I think it may be just endemic in the industry that that we know what we want, but publishers basically don't.
Is it 5 minutes?
5 minutes, okay.
So how much of Boys Life, Boys Life is your original vision, and how much is what the publisher wanted?
It's 100% mine.
Okay, so. You won that one.
Everything I've done, everything that's been published is 100% mine.
Okay. So we're not going to see, a author's preferred text or anything?
If whatever comes out and is between pages with my name on it, it's 100% mine.
What's interesting about Boys Life, I find it interesting, they did an audiobook version of it at the time. It was an abridged version. And it's basically what they tried to make him do to it.
See, I never listened to that.
They cut out all
the... That's their deal. They can take and do whatever they want to. I've never heard that.
But that's essentially what it is. It cuts out all the great stuff.
That's ridiculous.
It's just a murder mystery.
I know, it's ridiculous. That's
by far my favorite of yours.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm trying to find out.
Did you have another question?
I'm just curious, when it came out, did it match the sales of your previous novel when it first came out?
It was slow. It was slow because really Pocket didn't know what to do with it. You know, they felt they didn't understand it. They didn't know how to promote it. They didn't know. And at that time also, the money for promotion was beginning to be scarce. It began to pull back, so they weren't promoting as much. But this book has continued to grow unbelievably. People reading it, passing it by word of mouth. And you always hear, you know, this is the best thing for a book is to be praised by readers, word of mouth. And that's exactly what's happened in this case. I mean, really, it's amazing to me. But Pocket didn't know. And they still don't know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, I can't remember the first of your books that I found. I found them in the main library, Detroit Main Library, and new books. And I don't know why I picked your book. And so I read it. But it wasn't Boy's Life. It was some earlier book.
Yeah.
Is it paperback?
No. And they had, hardcover books. And I wondered, the next one comes out. But I didn't buy copies of them. But then when he got this, and then wasn't anything.
Yeah.
And I asked the librarian, do you have information, when is the next McCammon book coming? I don't know.
Yeah.
And then finally I saw...
Going South?
No.
Speaks of Nightbird.
Yeah, Speaks of Nightbird.
Right.
Oh, finally, there's something. But it's huge,
Yeah.
It's going to take... I'm going to have to, take this out about three times before I get through it.
That's good.
But I did,
Yeah. Well, it took me a while to come back. I really thought I was finishing the publishing business.
Yeah.
And the deal was I kind of turned my idea of maker off.
Mm-hmm.
And people said, what did you do with your ideas that you had? And you just turned it off. And but now that I'm back in it, it's like that's turned back on again. And the idea is just come, which is a great thing. But it's funny, though, how you kind of protect yourself. Because it's like I thought, I'm done. So what are the use of ideas? I just kind of turned it off. But if I had stayed retired, if I had stayed invisible and stayed out of it, I guess then they would have won. That would have been a bad thing.
So
talk about an idea maker. Just to say, Paul McCartney, being interviewed years ago when he had his Liverpool Opus coming out. And so he was being asked questions by people that were far more experienced composers on a higher level, he thought, than himself. And so they were asking him, where do some of these things come from when you're in a creative mode? And he said, it's really weird because sometimes you get up in the morning and you find it. It's like it's already there. And you just suddenly turned and looked out that window and went, oh.
Yeah. And the more you exercise, that is, the more it works.
Yeah. So it's interesting that it's probably, he was probably explaining it to somebody who was essentially imagination blind. Just as I can't explain red and green to a person who's been truly colorblind.
Yeah. Well, your term, I love that term, imagination blind.
Yeah.
Okay. See, that's what I think that when I go to speak in these high schools, I think that's what's happened, and these students are in danger of becoming imagination blind.
That and good logic.
And good logic.
I mean, the ability to look at a task and say, I'm going to do this and this and this. Is also sadly lacking in our kids, because they think it's going to.
Yeah.
Well, that's a real task that all of us have to do is to try to change that, keep that happen as much as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And they don't realize, right now that if they don't, if they lose the ability, their imagination development and their creative thinking, they're at the mercy of just. The furious,
But I think we have a bigger window than we realize, because just in my own family, grandkids came up with Pokemon.
Yeah.
And I thought, we all say, magical thinking goes away, relatively early. I had a 12 going on 13-year-old person who finally got brave in my family, with a niece. And she said, I wouldn't ask just anybody. She was embarrassed. It's almost 13. She said, I've got all this stuff memorized still. She's got 300 characters in Pokemon with the morphs and everything they do. And she said, I know we don't have them here. She was getting into anime. But in Japan, surely there's a Butterfree. which is, you know, it's one of the morphs of, oh, it comes in a beautiful butterfly, a particular kind. So surely somewhere, so the magical thinking was still there. The openness to the universe was still there. You know, and we all say to the kids over and over again, we give them magic pictures on TV, we give them magic pictures, and we say, but this is not real, but this is not real, but to them it is.
Yeah.
I was just listening to about a five-year-old upstairs, I was up in the con suite, and her mother was having a problem with her because she had a little pocket pack of, little fanny pack of toys of her own that she had brought, and she was refusing to eat the gummy bears because they were her friends.
Well, the thing is also, talking about Harry Potter books, people are hungry for, to use their imagination. They're hungry for food, imagination, food. That's absolutely true. And that's a very positive, good thing that people do. I think are always hungry and want that part of themselves to be fed. Can I sign some books, guys? I guess
for sure.
When else? Because these are all on the
Because I left all your books up in my room.
I will be doing an autograph in
five.
Yeah, so we'll do that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, sure.
Also, if you guys haven't ever visited robertmccammon.com, the website, I can't remember now, something like 15 short stories that you can find there that are uncollected. Most of them appeared in one magazine somewhere and never been seen again. But they're there for free.
We're kind of waiting. We'll sign on this guy last year.
So we'll see.
These two are not mine.
So every time he gets a particular, like maybe an anthem.
You never can tell. This is so much involved.
Really good fans or something.
So I
foresee a 50-story homemade anthology. That would be cranking together.
Cool.
Oh, what I was saying about the Kindles? Because I don't have them, but I've been, I have it at a bookstore for 15 years, and during the time I sell.